From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, new data quantifies the concentrated disadvantages of one Milwaukee neighborhood.
The longer-term structural problems facing 53206 are still very real, and they are still creating conditions of the most dire kinds of poverty and joblessness.
Later, Mount Mary University develops a program specifically to help students who haven't chosen a major.
I think in higher ed, we are understanding of the fact that perhaps many 18-year-olds are not sure what direction they want their career to go in.
And the River West band Pay the Devil brings us their version of bluegrass, a genre they affectionately call punkgrass.
I tend to think of this group as kind of like getting some of our energy from early punk rock music, where it's not flashy and it just kind of goes, you just kind of hit the gas and go forward.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. The economic and other disparities between residents of Milwaukee's central city and other parts of the metro area are well known. The suburbs in particular show lower rates of poverty and incarceration and higher income, education, and home ownership than many parts of the city. That is especially true for one zip code.
For many, 53206 has become a metaphor for the challenges facing inner city residents, especially people of color. The area's high incarceration rate and low employment rate have attracted national and even international reporting. A study out last month tries to quantify what it terms the ecosystem of disadvantage in 53206. Its author is Mark Levine, a professor emeritus of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee, and he is with us in the studio to share what he and his team learned. Welcome back to the show.
It's always a pleasure, Mitch. Thanks.
The title of this report references concentrated disadvantage, but you also use a couple of terms within the report that I wanted to ask you about just to kind of get us talking. There's the term cumulative disadvantage and ecosystem of disadvantage. I guess talk about what you're getting at with each of those terms.
Yeah, lots of jargon in there. And they generally, I think, all point to the same phenomenon, but they sort of emphasize different aspects of it. I mean, when we talk about concentrated disadvantage, we're talking about a number of disadvantages that obviously we talk about in the study,
right,
in terms of earnings inequality, income inequality, poverty, unemployment, you know the drill, all sort of concentrated in a geographic space, spatial kind of disadvantage. When we talk about cumulative disadvantage, that also refers to that concentration, but it refers to sort of an accumulation of those disadvantages, both interacting with one another and over time. And later on in the study, when we talk about an ecosystem, that more or less references the same kind of phenomenon of interlocking or interconnected kinds of disadvantages that form a kind of an ecosystem, for lack of a better term, that characterizes the entire kind of socioeconomic phenomenon that are occurring in the neighborhood.
The idea you can't isolate poverty from education and education from, say, housing or employment or whatever.
Right. All of the factors sort of contribute to one another and they create this concentration of disadvantage. And when we talk about the ecosystem, particularly, in the report when we discussed, for example, what the potential impact of improving education can be in various neighborhoods, we talk about the degree to which you have to look at that factor in the context of all of the other factors of what we're calling the ecosystem. So the ecosystem of the potential for somebody to get a job in a place like Waukesha County versus 53206 tend to be very different no matter what the education levels of individuals would be.
Well, and so anyone who has followed the coverage of the challenges Milwaukee faces is probably familiar with the dire straits that 53206 in particular is in. But there were some surprises, even in a positive sense, that employment numbers were actually up.
I think the good news in the study is that since the depths of the Great Recession, things have improved in 53206 in a number of areas. As you referenced, the employment rate has gone up. The poverty rate has come down. Poverty rate for children has also come down. So there are a few areas where we can say the trend line has improved. That has to be put, obviously, in the context being that the depths of the Great Recession, the absolute worst. Coming up from there has not even, in most of those areas, brought 5-3-2-0-6 back to where it was even in the year 2000, let alone when we get back into the 20th century. So the sort of the good news and the bad news is things have improved a little bit. The recovery has been trickling down. I'm absolutely certain that the work of many of the good organizations that are working hard on the ground in 5-3-2-0-6 are having an impact, and that's certainly helping things. But the bottom line is the longer-term structural problems facing 5-3-2-0-6 are still very real, and they are still creating conditions of the most dire kinds of poverty and joblessness.
And certainly the rate of improvement in 5-3-2-0-6 in comparison to the rate of improvement elsewhere is significantly lower.
Yeah, the rate of improvement generally is slower, although the employment rate certainly has climbed percentage-wise, probably a little bit faster than the rest of the metropolitan area, but that's because the rate, the base, was so much lower to begin with. I mean, at the depths of the Great Recession, only 36% of all of the working-age adults between the ages of 20 and 64 in 5-3-2-0-6 were employed. So that jumped to 47%, so that's about a, 35% increase. So that's pretty impressive. That's certainly better than lots of other areas, but it still means that fewer than half of the working age adults are employed, and that applies also to what we call the prime age working age adults between 25 and 54. When generally in a reasonably healthy labor market, you expect a very high percentage. In the suburbs, for example, in the 25 to 54 cohort, 90% are employed. In 5-3-2-0-6, it's 49%.
There are also a number of other discouraging signs in terms of employment, especially as educational attainment and employment intersect. How did those intersections compare with the other parts of the city and the metro area?
One of the most, I think, striking findings of the study is the degree to which education affects outcomes in various areas. We looked at employment, we looked at earnings of workers, we looked at household income, and we looked at poverty rates and looked at how education affected those. And one of the findings, which is of course not in the least bit surprising, was that education matters, so that the high school dropout in 5-3-2-0-6 is less likely to be employed than a college graduate living in 5-3-2-0-6. A high school dropout in 5-3-2-0-6 is likely to have lower household income than a college graduate or someone with some college or an associate's degree. So, as you move up the educational attainment ladder, economic outcomes improve. What we were, I think, particularly surprised to find was the degree to which, however, there were disparities when we controlled for education. So when we compared the outcomes for college graduates living in 5-3-2-0-6 versus a college graduate living, say, in Waukesha County, or a high school dropout in one jurisdiction versus high school dropout in another. So when we control for education, you find that, for example, the employment rate for a high school dropout in Waukesha County is almost three times the rate of a high school dropout in 5-3-2-0-6. And those disparities work as we go up and down the educational attainment ladder. But more strikingly, we saw disparities between, say, the employment rate or the poverty rate or the earnings of a high school dropout in a place like Waukesha County versus a college graduate or someone with just some college or an associate's degree, which is still, a higher form of education, living in 5-3-2-0-6. The poverty rate for a high school dropout in Waukesha County is about the same as for a college graduate living in 5-3-2-0-6. The earnings of a high school dropout living in Waukesha County are about the same as a college graduate living in 5-3-2-0-6. Employment rate in the Milwaukee suburbs as a whole for high school dropouts is about the same as for someone with some college in their educational attainment in 5-3-2-0-6. So education matters. But back to that earlier point when you asked about the ecosystem, there's an ecosystem of disadvantage. Is it where jobs are? Is it because there's racial discrimination? Is it because of the cumulative disadvantages, less health care available, that there's certainly more disability in employment disability in 5-3-2-0-6? All of those factors may affect the degree to which education can improve outcomes, but it's still nonetheless extraordinarily striking to see the disparity, for example, between the economic outcomes of a high school dropout or just a high school graduate in a place like Waukesha County or the Milwaukee suburbs generally, and more educated individuals living in 53206.
And so with this in mind, it should probably not surprise anyone to find that in general, the poverty rate in 53206 circa 2017 far exceeds the rest of the area.
It's about seven times, I believe, the rate, or six times the rate of the metropolitan area as a whole and the suburban areas. The poverty rate in 53206 is 42%. Again, you know, it's an improvement from the depths of the Great Recession when it was 47%, although statistically, because there's an error margin there, it's unclear that there's a huge difference there. But let's say it's declined a little bit. But it's still much, much higher than the city as a whole. It's much, much higher, obviously, than the suburbs. Again, the children's poverty rate, which reached a shocking, and that's the only word for it, 66%. Two-thirds of the children living in 53206 live below the poverty line at the depths of the Great Recession. That's come down to about 55%, but we're still talking about off-the-chart poverty rates.
Well, and along those lines, you studied something called intergenerational economic mobility. What does that concept mean, and how were you able to study that?
Intergenerational economic mobility refers to the degree to which you're able to do better than your parents did. So how did the children growing up in poor households in 53206 or throughout the rest of the metropolitan area do as they reached adulthood? Did they move to a higher economic bracket? Were their incomes higher than their parents, or were they in a better, technically we call it the percentile of the income distribution? So if they were born and raised in a family in the 25th percentile, which would be the low end of the income distribution, when they reached young adulthood, what percentile did they reach? We got access to very generously shared a database from the Harvard-based Equality of Opportunity Project, which has an extraordinary big database of Internal Revenue Service data that they've linked with Census Bureau data that they were able to get. All the individuals in it are de-identified, so there's no confidentiality breach at all. But from that data, you're able to track how children who grew up in various areas in the late 1970s and the early 1980s fared as adults in the middle part of the 2010s. So I think the income data that we have is for 2014, 2015. And so these are children who were born between 1978 and 83, and we're seeing what their condition is in 2014 and 2015. We found for black males growing up in 53206, born again into the 25th percentile, low end of the income distribution in the late 70s or early 80s, that by the time they reached adulthood, young adulthood, in 2014, 2015, they were in the 25th percentile. They had not achieved any intergenerational mobility. For white males, however, again, starting off in the same economic situation, starting off in the 25th percentile, but growing up in different ecosystems, the ecosystem, for example, of Waukesha County, which has more manufacturing job growth, which created greater opportunities certainly in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s.
Right, not the same kind of deindustrialization.
Precisely. You know, I mean, later on there is deindustrialization, yep. But the early movement of manufacturing jobs in Milwaukee was in fact from the central city to places like Waukesha, to New Berlin, and that sort of thing. So growing up there, some of the lower income and less educated youth in places like Waukesha County could achieve some mobility, so that those white males growing up in the Milwaukee suburbs and Waukesha in particular had risen from the 25th percentile to the 45th percentile. For females, it was a little more mobility for African Americans, but generally much, much less than, again, for whites. You know, what this tells us is clearly there are racial disparities in terms of economic mobility, the ability to climb the economic ladder. It also tells us that white poverty and black poverty are different. That growing up in concentrated poverty neighborhoods, which is where a large number of the African American poor grow up, is very different than growing up, even if you're poor, even if your household is poor, in an area where the schools are better, where there are more job opportunities, where there's less crime, and where poverty isn't as concentrated geographically in a neighborhood.
Finally, you look at incarceration rates and discover that this is still a significant issue in 53206, but apparently not quite to the level of hyperbole that's commonly used.
There's been a substantial amount of hyperbole about what is, in fact, a very, very serious problem. So let's start out by saying there's no gainsaying whatsoever the fact that mass incarceration is a major scourge afflicting 53206 and, in fact, the African-American community generally in Milwaukee. That said, for a variety of reasons, there's been a bit of, I think, exaggeration of the condition. There was documentary which referred to 53206 as the most incarcerated zip code in America. So we wanted to see if there was any data that would give us some insight in that. And one of the things we found out is how difficult it is to get really accurate, complete, usable data on incarceration for just Wisconsin and Milwaukee and for neighborhoods like 53206, let alone across the country. Again, we found a couple of interesting databases, one of which was, again, the Harvard Equality of Opportunity Project. Another one was data that the Brookings Institution has collected, which, again, looks at how children growing up in the late 70s and early 80s were faring in terms of whether they were incarcerated by 2010, 2012, 2014. The Brookings Project had data on zip codes. So we looked at that, and 53206 was not anywhere near the top. If you want to know the most incarcerated zip code in America, it's Nashville 37228, where almost 30% of males growing up in that zip code in the 70s and early 80s by 2010 ended up in prison, which is an extraordinary rate. The other database, again, was the Harvard base, which let us look at census tracts. And we looked at all of the census tracts within 53206 to see, again, what the incarceration rate was of children who grew up in 53206 in the late 70s and early 80s. And we found it ranged from about a low of 10% in some census tracts to about 35% in the worst. Again, a terrible incarceration rate. Clearly, we have a major problem. But we found that there are about 3,500 other census tracts in the country that had higher incarceration rates. So by this measure, and this is just one way of measuring it, you know, we can say that the incarceration rate in 53206 is terrible, but it's not certainly the worst in the United States. What we also did was collect data to just get a snapshot of today and say, you know, what is the percentage of black males at various ages in 53206 who are either incarcerated or under the supervision of the State Department of Corrections. It's a very complicated issue to get the third category, which is ex-offenders who are off paper, who are not showing because they're off paper, so we don't have, you know, data on them. And what we found was, as I think is generally sort of known in the community, very, very high incarceration rates for black males between 20 and 64. About a quarter are either incarcerated or are under the active supervision of the Department of Corrections between the ages of 25 and 34 in 53206, over 40%, about 42%. Again, those are a little bit lower than some of the numbers that are put out, but they're not extraordinarily lower. But again, we can't compare that to other zip codes across the country. But the expectation is that there are going to be a lot of zip codes, and this is a very sad expectation, that are at least at that level or if not higher.
Well, and as a researcher, is you know, the listicle, the ranking an enemy?
Yeah. I mean, it distorts and it creates a sort of a pseudo sort of scientific, you know, this is the worst, this is the second worst. I mean, what you want to know is, you know, what the general rates are of anything, and what does that tell you? What does that measurement tell you about conditions in the neighborhood? So whether, and I think this is a very important point to underscore, whether 53206 is the most incarcerated zip code in the United States or if it's the 250th most incarcerated, it's still a zip code that has much, much too high a level of mass incarceration, and that level of mass incarceration is one of the integral elements of the cumulative disadvantages that we outline in the report. It's a fundamental feature of this ecosystem of disadvantage that creates the inequalities that we document in employment, in earnings, in income, in housing, and the like.
Well, and as an ecosystem, it seems like the message here is that this is not like a chain of dominoes. There's not one domino you can pull out that stops all this stuff from happening.
No, quite the contrary. I mean, you clearly need a comprehensive approach. I mean, this is not a study that was then geared to sort of putting out a list of what policy solutions are out there, certainly over the last 3 decades that I've been working on these issues in Milwaukee. It's a long time. I've certainly put out, you know, some ideas that I think would make sense. But I think simply studying at this granular level the interaction and the accumulation of all of these disadvantages gives us a sense of what the key factors are, and the fact that you can't just sort of pick one and say, okay, we're going to deal with housing here and that's going to then take care of the employment situation. Or the other way around, saying, you know, it's jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, yes, it is, but creating jobs is not as simple as it appears just by sort of saying the slogan jobs, 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 given the impact of incarceration, given the disinvestment of businesses from the central city. I mean, you can go down the list of various issues. And by saying that these are cumulative, I certainly would hope that someone doesn't say, well, let's just throw up our hands. We can't do anything about it. But it means that we have to obviously have a holistic, comprehensive approach to these issues.
Mark Levine, thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Mitch.
Mark Levine is a professor emeritus of history, economic development, and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. He's the author of a study published by the UWM Center for Economic Development. It's called Milwaukee 53206, The Anatomy of Concentrated Disadvantage in an Inner-City Neighborhood, 2000 to 2017. You'll find a link to it from WUWM.com, and we first spoke with Mark Levine last month.
We will take a quick break now, and then how one college is working to smooth the first year of college for students trying to figure out which major they're working towards. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR. Back now with more of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. If you went to college, how long did it take before you settled on the major that your diploma would carry?
Some of us may have gone through 9 incarnations before figuring it out, the irony being number 1 and number 9 wound up being the same.
For some young people, just heading off to college can be challenging enough, even before deciding on what course of study might carry them through their adult life. One Milwaukee area school is trying to make navigating that undecided part of the college experience a little easier.
Dr. Christine Farr is president of Mount Mary University, which recently announced its Compass Year program for undecided students, and she's with us by phone. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here today.
What has the general attitude, not just at Mount Mary, but in, you know, academia, higher education, as you've seen it, what has it been in working with students who are undecided about the course of study they're going to pursue?
I think in higher ed, we are understanding of the fact that perhaps many 18-year-olds are not sure what direction they want their career to go in. Often, they have a general idea, but they don't know specifically. And we understand that this is kind of a stressful position, especially for the students and sometimes also for their parents. And so I think in general, we've tried to help accommodate them. But I don't know that we have particularly responded in the past as well with something that was concretely addressing their specific needs.
Has there been a stigma attached to kids who are undecided?
I don't know that higher ed feels that way so much, but I think there is certainly a sense that, you know, college is expensive and time-consuming, and too many students are taking too long to get through college. And so I think in general, there's this sense that you better know what you want to do. And I would say that's more of a societal perception than a higher ed perception. But I think, you know, we all recognize that we want students to have the ability to make good decisions and to complete their college education in a timely way. So I suppose you could say there's a stigma, but I think more than anything, there's just a concern that students are really moving forward in a direction that makes sense in a timely way.
Well, at the same time, grasping, I gather that it's asking a lot of someone who's maybe 18 or 19 years old to know so well what they would like to do before they arrive at college.
Absolutely. I mean, most of us, myself included, have no idea where our life is going to go. And in fact, about 80% of college-going students either don't know what they want to do when they come to college or change their major within the first couple years. So that suggests that the vast majority of people really don't know at 18 what they want to do. And that means that there is a tremendous need out there to help people find their way and to develop the kind of knowledge and skills that will help guide them wherever their career path takes them.
Do socioeconomic factors play into it? Do you find that students, maybe especially like first-generation college students or people who otherwise have had challenges before they get to school, have particular problems versus the student body at large, or is this really showing itself across the spectrum?
You know, I think it does show itself across the spectrum. In general, there certainly are some socioeconomic factors in the sense that I believe that students who come from families where parents have well-defined careers and they're exposed to those, usually they either know that they really want to do something like that or they don't. so they may not feel that, I want to do what mom and dad did. But in many families, for example, if we see a family full of people in the medical profession, often many of the students or the kids in those families are interested in pursuing that career route. Or the same thing is often the case where there are teachers in the family or people that are educators. But I think a lot of times for students who have not been exposed to a vast variety of careers, especially first-generation students, as you mentioned, they may not even know what the possibilities are. And so I think part of it is education about, you know, how do your gifts and talents match up with the needs that are out there in the bigger world?
Is there a cost that's been being paid at the end of the, you know, the other end of the academic equation when students get out into the workforce if they've had this kind of ambiguity going through school? Does it cause problems once they're in the workforce?
Well, I think it certainly does. I mean, if take, for example, someone who decides that they want to be a teacher and then find out that they absolutely hate being in the classroom. Now, I want to say that I do think higher ed has taken a pretty proactive approach to that in that we're trying more and more to give students opportunities in the first few years of college to experience different careers through things like job shadowing and bringing in experts so that someone doesn't head down a path where they're going to be really miserable. But I think there have been students who've gone through and ended up with a degree that really wasn't what they wanted to do, or, you know, even more commonly, graduating with a degree that they didn't know what they could do with it. Like, they know, for example, that they're very good in a particular discipline and that they enjoy it, but they don't know exactly what to do with it for a job, for example.
Well, so then walk us through how the Compass program was conceived and the way you see it working over the course of a student's academic career.
Sure. So way back, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I was at a conference and a fellow there said, you know, if somebody was really smart, they would create a program for undecided students because there are so many and so many students who are uncertain. And I have been chewing on this idea for some time. And so when I came to Mount Mary a couple of years ago, I really thought, looking at our student demographic and what I'm seeing in higher ed today in terms of people wanting to reduce costs and decrease time to graduation, that maybe this was the right time and place to really consider that. And so about a year ago, I gathered together a group of about 20 people on the Mount Mary campus and said, look, I think we need to create a program that's specifically geared towards students who are undecided, because I think that the students and their parents are very concerned about this today. And so if we created this program that in the course of 1 year would really make it easier for them to determine what they want to study and what kind of career choice they want to make and still be able to get done in 4 years, I think it would be a huge advantage. And so this group of people sat down and it brought together people from all different avenues within the university, people in obviously faculty, people in student support services, people like the registrar's office and marketing, different groups that I thought were really relevant to making the program go. And they just began to work on a plan that would be very much address the needs of the students coming in this situation. And so they created a one-year program. They conversed with me pretty regularly on it, as well as the academic vice president. And then at the end of about a year, we had, in the meantime, developed a number of marketing materials so we could really let people know that this existed And we are now launching it in fall of 19 at Mount Mary.
Well, and so what does it look like when a student walks in the door and doesn't know what her major is going to be, or maybe, you know, just doesn't quite have a sense for what her path through school is going to be? You know, what are the interventions, or what are the programs or processes that will help her?
Sure. So the first aspect of the Undecided program is really talking to students and parents when they're looking for a college and letting them know that this kind of a program exists. And the way we would describe this to parents or students would be that the students start at Mount Mary about 3 days before the semester, and that's what we call the jump start. This brings all the students together who are undecided. So first of all, they're developing a cohort with other students who are in the same boat, people who may not be exactly sure where they want to go. And during those 3 days, they will do a number of self-assessments, interests, career knowledge, passions, and try and help understand what they really enjoy doing and what they're very good at doing. They'll also develop relationships with these other students so that as they move into the first semester, they're in a bit of a cohort. Now, when I say that, I don't mean exclusively, like they're not going to be taking all the same courses with these students, but they will for sure be taking a few together. And one in particular that starts in the fall semester is a course on career exploration. And so what we try and do immediately is help the students identify how their interests, their gifts, their talents match up with the various types of disciplines that are offered and that are available at the college, as well as trying to make sure that they pick coursework that first semester that heads them down the right path. And I think this is a really critical aspect of the program. What we call this is choosing a meta major. So a meta major is not a major, it's a general discipline. So do you find that you're interested in education, in healthcare, in mental health, different types of broad categories? And that helps us direct students into taking various foundational courses that will head them down that path. As they continue to work through this first course, they'll sort of refine their thinking. And then during the second semester, they'll move into a second career exploration class. During these courses, they will continue to explore their interests. They'll also have guest speakers. They'll do some job shadowing and try and get a sense of what it actually feels like to be in a particular type of job or career so that they know what they're getting into. All along the way, we have a strong set of advisors that will be working with these students to help guide them along their choices of courses and experiences so that by the end of the first year, it is our hope that we will have a celebration and that the vast majority of students will be ready to choose a major.
At the end of the day, though, or the end of 4 years or however many years, is there anything inherently wrong with still some unknowns as one walks out the door of college?
Absolutely. And I think, I think I'm a really good example of that myself. You know, my undergraduate degree was in chemistry, which sounds like a great undergraduate degree to have, but what do you do with it? I wasn't sure. And so I think this often happens to students is they go out and they try to begin to understand what is possible. A good example of this might be in chemistry right now at Mount Mary. There are many types of jobs that you could find when you graduate, but we have now created a degree in food science chemistry. So given the food corridor of Minnesota and Wisconsin, we recognize that there are huge employment opportunities in the sciences for people who have expertise in food science. So that's just an example of an application of a discipline that might help a student pick where they want to go with a particular discipline.
And in fairness, I think we've had good chemistry in this interview.
Yes, thank you.
Well, Dr. Christine Farr, thank you so much. Best of luck with this program. And actually, I'm sure we would love to check back in at the end of that first year and see how it's worked.
That would be great. We're working yet on our final end of the year celebration. I think that's going to be something really special. And so we'll get back to you and let you know how that comes out.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you too, Mitch.
Christine Farr is the president of Mount Mary University. You'll find a link to more information about the school's Compass Year program at WUWM.com.
We will take one last break, and then the punk bluegrass sound of the River West Band Pay the Devil graces our performance studio. Lake Effect returns right after this on 89.7 WUWM.
It is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. The instruments are found in your basic bluegrass band lineup. Banjo, mandolin, guitar, bass. But the sound they produce in the hands of the members of Pay the Devil is far grittier than most bluegrass outfits make.
The River West Bass Band writes songs that could easily be part of the American folk tradition, but they're presented with a punk edge that keeps them from sounding like museum pieces. They released a new album last month and stopped by then to give us a preview. The song we're hearing is called To Hell With Luck. Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's performance studio with To Hell With Luck. Lady and gentlemen, it is a pleasure to have you in the studio. Back in the studio for most of you. I mean, my goodness, it's been like, what, 4 years?
Yeah. Something similar to that.
Yeah. And Jackie, you're the new kid on the block.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah. So welcome.
Thanks.
So what have you been doing in 4 years? What's been going on?
Oh, that's a really good question. What have we been doing?
Recording.
We've been recording just about that entire time. So this album that's coming out soon, we've been working on just about since then. We picked up Jackie. We picked her up two St. Patrick's days ago.
Standing by the side of the road.
Two of us got married. There were three babies in the band.
To each other, no.
Not to each other. Yeah.
No,
not
nobody's married to each other.
No one's married to each other.
We did attend each other's weddings.
But Bonnie, you would like to know this because this show actually is the reason why Jackie is with us now. Because when we played the first time, her husband, Mike, was listening and said, he knew me, and he was like, oh, I didn't know that you were in this band, Pay the Devil. And I was like, yeah, I am. And he's like, oh, I just heard it on Bonnie North's show. And then he was like, my wife plays bass. And so then that's kind of how we got connected with Jackie.
That's fantastic.
Exactly.
It's coming full circle now, you know.
So you're saying it's Lake Effect's fault.
Yes.
Totally.
It's the Lake Effect, you know.
It's the Lake Effect.
Yeah.
I think what he's saying is that Lake Effect is to thank. Serendipitous turn of events.
About adding a wonderful bass player to the already exalted lineup.
Emphasis on exalted.
Exalted. Well, I also remember this band, of course, is the band with two Ivans.
Yeah, that's true.
So we should probably, other than Jackie, we should probably go down and say who everyone is because people won't remember from 4 years ago.
That's true.
So starting with this Ivan.
Yeah, I'm the guitar player, Ivan Baker. Ivan and I were the first members, I guess.
Yeah, and I'm the banjo player, Ivan Eisenberg.
I'm Jeremy Ault. I play the drum and then other percussive things.
The washboard.
Yeah, the washboard. Yeah.
Fun.
I'm Matt. I'm the mandolin player. I was Ivan's cousin. He called me one day. He's like, hey, do you want to be in a band? And I was like, yeah. And yeah, it worked out really well.
So how long has the group been together in some form or another? It's been quite a few years.
Yeah, well, you just shared that thing, right? How long ago was that?
That was 7 years ago. It was the first time we were on stage was yesterday, 7 years ago. And that was at an open mic night at Linneman. Was our first time ever being on stage.
We didn't even have the name yet. We were still twice as terrible.
Yeah.
So like we had the worst pun name ever.
Yeah,
we
other
were like,
Ivan
two
puns.
Ivan the terrible, twice as terrible.
Twice as terrible. I kind of like it actually.
Yeah. Ivan working on the railroad.
Oh yeah, that one never stuck. Oh, that's way worse. Oh god.
Yeah.
Oh man. So at that Linneman show, we called in. We're like, hey Jim, can we get a spot? Like we want to play, and he said yeah, and so over the phone we told someone to sign us up, and we got signed up as twice as parable, like we were some sort of
biblical group.
Yeah.
Our name still has a biblical connotation to it.
Right.
In a different way, you know?
So yeah, we got, I think that might have killed it. Did we say like, let's get a different name? Like was that what did it?
I like it. So you went from parable to devil.
I kind of like that.
Accidental parable to devil.
I like accidental parable. That should be the name of your next album.
That's true. I like it.
So, and that's another Lake Effect thing. You can give us credit.
Yeah,
for
right,
that.
Right now the front runner for the next album, We Can League It Right Now, I think is the worst thing about a rainbow, or the worst thing about rainbows. We'll see. But yeah,
like, Accidental Parable is pretty good.
Accidental Parable is strong.
If we regroup as a indie rock band, I think that'd be great.
Why not? You know, lots of people play these kind of instruments. The genre lines have blended and merged, and I don't think you have to worry about that. But no, this is so firmly in bluegrass. It's one of the things I really like. But it's bluegrass with an edge. It's sort of like whiskey bluegrass. And I'm just so glad you guys are still doing it, and you've got this album coming out. I understand that it's taken almost the time since you were here last to actually get the album finally out? Because I remember we were talking about it last time.
Yeah, we were. I think we were in here like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and we were saying things like, oh, we have the next one like half in the bag already. Like, this is...
And the best laid plans of Mice and Men. And,
it's
and
hard.
Here you are. But you all got married, babies, you know, that kind of eats it. And working, you know, actually doing the day jobs and all of that stuff.
Yeah, unmarketable music doesn't pay that well. I think we're relatively unmarketable. So
next album's out going to be right away, though, for sure.
Yeah, we have it half in the bag.
And in 4 years from now, when you come back, you'll say, wait, we just came to the, exactly.
How many babies do you guys have now?
Same number.
Yeah. Same.
One more album.
One more album. Exactly. Well, let us hear another song. Tell me what you're going to play for us.
This is going to be
Sitting Up Here.
And what's the background for this tune?
Oh, I have a good story about this one. So this song's probably from 2012, 2013,
the
impetus of the song. And it was, I think it was initially just like a, well, I'm sitting up here as like a joke, like to sort of like make fun of somebody's background singing.
Mine. Make one of my background.
Sorry, to make one of our mandolin players deciding to sing way up high. And we're like,
the high tenor. You're doing the high tenor part, huh?
It wasn't bad, but we were just like, so we're just like,
I don't do it anymore. So it wasn't bad.
It started as like a major key, like a flippant joke. And then we just kept playing it. Like the tune stuck around. And then I think as a joke one day, we shifted it to a minor key. And then it kind of wrote itself. Like all of a sudden it became like not a joke song. It sort of became a real song. And I wrote a few verses and Ivan Baker wrote a few verses and we cut out like a weird bridge. And then it was, I think it's one of our favorite songs. Mm-hmm. I think it became so it's funny. It started, now with the lyrics and it sort of instead of telling like this sort of joke about singing register, it tells sort of like four vignettes of working class people. And I like to think that the chorus is sort of a chance to sort of take a breath and reflect on your life and realize that like you don't need everything to be okay, and like the stories that the people are telling in the song are hard, but the sitting up here for no reason, sitting up here just passing time is just sort of that like take a breath and like everything's okay and you don't need to do everything. So
Well, let's hear it. This is Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's performance studio with Sitting Up Here.
Sitting up here, just passing time. Sitting up here.
And that was Pay the Devil in Lake Effect's performance studio with Sitting Up Here. I like it in the minor key. And I also love, and I have to say, I don't remember this from the first time you were here, the two of you trading off, the two Ivans trading off verses, you know, because you have very different voices and it really brings something interesting to the whole song. The yeah. fact that you do that, there isn't just one lead singer.
Yeah, there was a period of time where it was summer and everybody was busy, and so it was just Ivan and I for a handful of practices in a row. And instead of just jamming like we used to, we were like, let's get some work done. And so Ivan would propose some of these songs that were just hanging there for years. So we started chipping away at them, and that's kind of how they got finished.
Yeah, and again, with both of you singing, taking turns, it's really good. And then having all of you guys coming in on the harmony stuff is really a lot of fun.
Yeah, so. Jackie's backup vocals have added a ton. So like a bunch of these songs. So that song predates, I mean, that song predates like, almost as an old band, right? Like that's an old song, but Jackie's vocal part. Oh, it's just so nice. Cause the rest of us sort of sing like sort of work song style, right? Like all in the same octave, all in the same note, really. Like just a sort of like a group chorus. And Jackie just adds so much like texture to that.
Did you always sing and do bluegrass stuff with the bass, or were you doing other kinds of music?
I was really doing other kinds of music before this. It's been great to learn a new set of genres, not just bluegrass, but old time. And the band has a huge repertoire, especially Ivan is famous for his memory for songs, and they play a lot of traditionals from different genres, but a lot of original music. And I've really enjoyed getting to know this kind of music.
Well, and the other thing, and of course the radio audience can't see this, but Ivan, you play the banjo, but you're playing clawhammer.
Yeah.
You're doing a clawhammer style, which is an old-fashioned style of playing. It's not the three-finger Scruggs style. And so what drew you to clawhammer?
So my dad's a mandolin player. I played the guitar as a kid, like every other kid who grows up with music in the house. And I switched to banjo, like sort of embarrassingly, because there weren't that many banjo players. And I thought like it was a way I could maybe set myself apart from the crowd, because I wasn't the best guitar player and was never going to be. So not that I'm the best banjo player, but like, so I switched, and I didn't know that many people that played. So this gentleman, Barry Smith, from a band, I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, and the band's from Union City, Pennsylvania, and the Tiger Maple String Band. And he played, and he learned from like a Rachel Eddy and, Richie Stearns. So Richie Stearns is in a band, The Horseflies. They're pretty popular. They're a national touring act. And it's sort of like a trance bluegrassy music. They're really good out of Ithaca, New York, if you haven't heard.
I haven't. I have to look them up now.
But he's like Barry and Richie and Rachel Eddy all sort of play this. Well, Rachel Eddy's a traditional. She's brilliant. She's great. The other two guys are too, but they just sort of play this strange, like sort of droney version of clawhammer. And that's what I was most introduced to. So playing a little bit with Barry when I was younger, I got interested in clawhammer and sort of tried to make it my own. I play a little bit of three-finger style, but yeah, almost never. There's a lot of that. You know, like I don't really want to compete with the like bluegrass Nashville three-finger guys. Like there's fewer clawhammer. I'm just trying to find a small pond, and I'll just live in that pond.
I like the way it fits into what you do too, because it's so driving, but it's driving in a different way than the three-finger style is. It's very rhythmic, but also melodic, and it works so well, Jerry, with what you're doing with all of that kind of old-fashioned percussion.
Yeah, I really like that you said driving. I tend to think of this group as kind of like getting some of our energy from early punk rock music, where it's not flashy and it just kind of goes, you just kind of hit the gas and go forward. And I think that's like part of our appeal. I don't think we're ever going to blow anybody away with technicalities and melodies, but I think people get into music when it's as accessible and there's energy to it, and it can be relatable. And I think that's what like early folk music has too. And I think we kind of get into that a little bit. And you could talk about the clawhammer banjo. You could talk about straightforward rhythms or just like straightforward strumming. I think that's definitely attractive.
Well, and you've got the flat picking going on over on your side, and you've got the mandolin stuff happening. So there's a lot of traditional elements happening. But I like the idea. The punk is a really good description. It's kind of like punk bluegrass. I was thinking of what's the Boston-based band that it was like Flogging Molly that kind of took Celtic and just like added punk and rock to it. It's kind of like you're doing that for bluegrass. It's the same idea.
Yeah.
We've been called chanty grass before. You know, like, I think that's actually quite an apt term.
I like that.
Or riot grass.
Or riot grass.
That's another good one.
Ooh, yeah. Riot grass.
Kind of gets into the Riot Girl feel, too. You know, I like that as well.
Sort of anarchic, you know. That's that's what's really great about it is just, you feel like it's going to, like, go somewhere at any moment. But it's all
We always feel maybe like we're about to get off the rails, but, you know, never quite do.
Never do.
Never.
sometimes
we absolutely do, but
well,
it's all for fun.
Speaking of getting off the rails, in the last thing you're going to wrap up for us, you kind of go off the rails a little bit, but on purpose. So before we get to that, though, I want to thank you guys for coming in and playing for us. It's just been fantastic to see you all again, Jackie, to meet you. So what are you going to take us out with that almost goes off the rails?
This song's a Big Black Bear, and Ivan's probably better to talk about it than I am.
Yeah, so yeah, my dad wrote this song originally, most of it. I just finished it off. It was, I was raised with a little bit of bluegrass that in the household my dad played. But, this song I always thought was written by somebody else, and I went to search it some years back just after he had died, and I couldn't find it anywhere. And I was felt like maybe he actually did write it and he wasn't, you know, giving me bull crap, you know. I introduced it maybe, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, and then we started adding it into the set and recorded it, and the rest is history.
All right. We're going to hear Big Black Bear and Black Bear Free For All to take us out. Lady and gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
There's a big black bear way up in.
Pay the Devil is Ivan Eisenberg, Ivan Baker, Jackie Lally, Matt Givens, and Jeremy Ault. The band recently released a new album, and you'll find more about it at WUWM.com. That is all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air comes your way next.